I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Chuck Close, one of America's leading contemporary painters. He's known mostly for his oversized portraits. Close up, his paintings seem like abstract increments of color, but when one steps back, a precise representational head emerges. Chuck started painting when he was 5 years old, and despite his learning and physical disabilities, his paintings are the darlings of leading museums and art collectors. His works hang in New York's Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, and the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., among others. Welcome. I'd like to understand how you got here, and I'd like to start with your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the state of Washington, of very modest means. My father was a kind of jack of all trades, itinerant inventor, and he'd been very ill his whole life. And he went to work for the Army Air Corps and later the Air Force because he needed health insurance. And my mother was a classically trained pianist who had had hopes of performing, and but the Depression came along and sort of wiped out that the possibility.
And were you an only child?
I was an only child. My father's an only child, and my mother's an only child. Both of them are dead, so I have none of my original family left at all.
Did you feel special as a child growing up in any way?
Well,
I had
really unusual parents. A real role reversal. My father, because he was so ill and sickly, did most of the things that women did. He cooked and baked, and my mother mowed the lawn and fixed the car. And I was very severely learning disabled. Long before I was physically disabled, I was learning disabled. But as anybody who was alive in the 40s and 50s know, there was no such thing as learning disabilities or dyslexia. Then you were simply dumb and lazy and a shirker or malingerer. But even from a very early age, I knew that I wanted to make things for other people to see. So I did puppet shows and magic acts and other things to sort of entertain the troops. And also, the first thing that I felt good at, better than my friends, was draw. Everyone needs to feel special, and I was so bad academically and clumsy and unathletic. So luckily, I got a tremendous amount of support from my family, and they helped me. They really made me feel special and appreciated.
So you had a healthy self-confidence despite your mm-hmm. learning disability.
And art saved my life academically as well, because the most important thing you can do as a learning disabled student is show your teachers that you are interested in the material and in the course, even though you're not going to be able to spit back the names and dates and things in the test.
So you charmed your way into a B?
I did, and I'm not all the way to the B, perhaps, but so I would schlep in a 20-foot-long mural of Lewis and Clark Trail as extra credit to mitigate for my poor performance in history class, for instance.
How did you then go from Washington to the East Coast?
I'd always said if I hadn't gone to Yale, I could have gone to jail. either way, it was a toss-up.
You got into Yale because you were considered special at the University of Washington, and there was a summer program at Yale mm-hmm. that you applied for.
You know, in life, when people say that someone is focused, I think more often than not what they're really saying is that you're narrow. Mm-hmm. And because I wasn't good at anything else and had all my eggs in this one basket, I distinguished myself from my classmates by being hungrier, caring more, and working harder. It wasn't that I was any more talented than most of the rest of the students, and talent is a dime a dozen anyhow. But at any rate, I think I just knew that if I couldn't make this art thing work, there was no fallback position. There was nothing else I was any good at.
Right. And you didn't necessarily wallow in your misery about being learning disabled. You just sort of put that aside and said, all right, I'm just going to suck that up and look straight ahead.
Well, I've always been an optimistic person, a positive person. And I think many of the coping strategies that I evolved as a learning disabled student put me in good stead to cope with having become a quadriplegic. Many of these coping strategies are things that they now teach mm-hmm. learning disabled people, but I sort of evolved them on my own.
You, in 1988, had an artery collapse in your spine, mm-hmm. causing you to be disabled. And had somebody predicted that prior, that this would have happened to you, would you have predicted that you would have been able to get through this so strongly?
It's very hard to predict who's going to be able to handle something and who isn't. Sometimes the person you most assume would be able to cope with it crumbles and falls apart, and someone else who's always seemed sort of weak and not particularly strong all of a sudden rallies and actually ends up being much stronger than anybody had any reason to assume. In my particular case, I think I've always known you can have a winning hand and find a way to lose it, or you can have a losing hand and find a way to make it work for you and win.
I always say that 10% of life is what happens to you, and 90% of your life is how you respond to it.
Mm-hmm. I always have said about being an artist that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. I mean, if you're sitting around waiting for the clouds to part and to be struck in the head with a bolt of lightning in order to be inspired enough to go do something, you're probably never going to get anything done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you just get to work, all sorts of things will occur to you through the process.
You seem very practical to me, and obviously very eloquent and well-spoken. It's hard to believe that you do have a learning disability.
Learning disabled people are often very articulate because, first of all, we're not dumb. We just have problems. We have deficits. If you're not destroyed by your learning disabilities, you're probably going to be a pretty strong person. And you have to be charming as hell because you are faking your way through life. You're not going to, I don't remember anybody's names. I don't remember anybody's faces. So I'm sort of floating through life, not knowing, where I'm at and who I'm talking to. So I have to be very charming and seductive in order to have things work out well for me. So a large percentage of successful dyslexics and learning disabled people, that they're articulate and they can convince people, to take a chance on them.
I love that you are bold enough to admit that you are charming.
It's one more coping mechanism. I mean, I know how to be charming. Maybe it's even fake, but I know how to do it. I know how to turn it on.
All right. Well, we'll see if I'm charmed by the end
okay.
of this interview.
You'll be the judge of that, right?
Right. Yeah. Did you ever try to take any drugs for your learning disability?
I wasn't diagnosed with them until relatively late in life. I did try one drug. It made me feel awful. But at this point, I am who I am. I'm extremely lucky. I do what I want to do every day of my life, and I manage to get paid to do it. So I don't have any real desire to change anything much.
I want to go back to something you said. You said you don't remember people's names or their faces.
Right.
Yet your entire job is focusing on the face.
I'm sure every aspect of my work was driven on one hand, one degree or another, by my learning disabilities. For instance, I don't recognize faces, but if I commit something to a flat surface, then I have virtually photographic memory. So I have to take this person who I don't recognize walking around, and I have to flatten them out and make that an image that I can. So I'm sure that I was driven to make portraits to commit to memory the images of people that I know and care about. I was overwhelmed by the whole. And so I broke everything down into small bite-sized pieces, which is why I make my work incrementally. There's an aspect of what I do that's also like what used to be called women's work, knitting, crocheting, quilting, whatever. And these activities are very calming. It's a little bit like raking gravel in a Zen Buddhist garden. So it's no accident that I gravitated towards what I do.
And you're also a self-proclaimed Slav, but your paintings are, I guess in the increments, they could be perceived as messes of color, but they are precise and require a lot of patience. And you've also said you're impatient. Is it a form of therapy for you?
Well, people who know me really well can't figure out how I ended up doing what I'm doing, because they know that I have no patience and no attention, short attention span, and I have, and I'm a slob and a nervous wreck, all of which would seem to preclude making work like what I make. But I didn't want to be held captive by my nature. I didn't want to think there's only one kind of art I can make because that's who I am. Big, sloppy, messy, tentative paintings. So I thought to construct a situation in which I would not be able to wallow in my nature is also to deal with my nature. I'm just going to construct limitations which will not allow me to do what seems so self-indulgent.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family life now? You are married with two daughters?
Yes. I met my wife when I was teaching in Amherst, Massachusetts in the 60s. She was an artist, and we moved to New York together. And she's now a landscape historian.
And her name's Leslie.
Which is actually my father's name, too. All important people in my life were named Leslie. Almost immediately I got to Amherst, I realized what a terrible mistake I'd made, because I really wanted to go to New York instead. An interesting thing took place. I thought I could be a teacher and an artist. So at the beginning, I was an artist who also taught. By the end of the first year, I was a teacher who also made art. By the end of the second year, I was a teacher who used to make art. So I learned very quickly that this was not going to make me happy. And that I better get my butt to New York, where I really wanted to be all along, and just try to pursue, making paintings and survive somehow.
Well, lucky for you that you had that realization in your mid-20s than in your mid-70s.
it's really fortunate in my case that I have known for virtually my whole life exactly what I wanted to do. That kind of single-minded pursuit of it didn't leave much room for doubt. But I know many, many people who are still in their 40s and 50s trying to figure out what they want to do.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. We'll hear more from Chuck coming up. Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the painter Chuck Close. He's known for his paintings of heads, and in the 1960s and 70s, the heads were more photorealistic. Over the past few decades, he switched to a more abstract, colorful form of painting. The process seems a little more random, and the painting is in the form of colorful increments, but the result is precise. His paintings hang in New York's Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney, and the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. I want to go back to your early days in the 60s and 70s, when painting was becoming less popular. You've said before that you think there's no better time to make painting than when others think painting is dead.
Well, I've been around long enough to have painting be dead already several times in my career. And I do think that that's a time when it's a particularly good to be a painter, because you probably are making work for your own reasons rather than larger global art world reasons that something is hot or not. Anytime you chase what's hot, you are chasing. You are behind the pack. Whereas if you do what you want to do and follow it wherever it goes, the buffeting winds of change that blow through the art world won't affect you very much. And you won't be tempted to simply try and make this month's hot product.
So let's take for a second that you don't follow the whims of the market and you don't necessarily paint to please your customers. How do you expect to make a living?
Well, you know, I never expected to make a living from my work. And, you know, one of the very few artists do. I mean, 99.99% of artists have to have some other kind of career to support their profession. I couldn't have been more surprised when it turned out that we could, in fact, sell a 9-foot-high painting of someone else. Who would want one? It didn't make sense. I never anticipated that these things would sell. The only person who was even more surprised than me was my dealer, who also thought it was impossible. But I'll tell you this, had I attempted to make decisions based on financial success, I would have made all the wrong moves. I definitely would not be where I am today had that been a goal. There were other aspects of success that were far more important to me. Recognition, getting my work out in front of people, critical success. I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted the work to be seen, but it frankly never occurred to me that I would be financially successful. And in fact, I don't really care about money, and I think that's one reason why I have so much of it. if that's what you're trying to do, you'll make very different decisions. For instance, instead of making a 9-foot-high portrait of someone else, I would have done commissioned portraits. I would have been painting college presidents and CEOs.
So who was the first person that wanted to buy your 9-foot painting?
Before I ever had a solo exhibition in New York City, I'd sold to museums. I didn't want my work to just be the plaything of wealthy people with a lot of discretionary extra income to spend. I really wanted them out in front of people of all financial means. My very first sale was to the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, an incredible museum.
Was that Martin Friedman?
Martin Friedman, yeah. Bought the first painting for $1,300. Took 2 years to pay for it, $650 a year for 2 years. The Whitney bought my fourth or fifth one. From the very beginning, I had that kind of institutional support, which surprised the hell out of me.
So you said your first painting sold for $1,300. Mm-hmm. Did you price that painting?
Mm-hmm.
And why $1,300?
Well, I'll tell you exactly why we did it. We kept the prices extremely low in order to put them into public collections, because institutions have a little bit of discretionary funds to buy art, not very much. And if things get too expensive, you price yourself out of a museum's range. And then you have to depend on wealthy people to buy it and give it to a museum. So we artificially kept the prices very low in order to place them.
Great business decision, Chuck.
I guess. And am I charming yet?
You're working on it.
I'm working on it. Okay. You're probably not going to believe this, but I swear that it's true. I don't know what my paintings sell for now. I let my gallery make that decision in order that there's no connection between what I do and the money that comes in. The work leaves the studio and money comes in, and in my mind, there's virtually no connection between the two. Fantasy, I suppose, that there's no connection, makes it easier for me to convince myself that I'm simply going in the studio to do what I love to do best. I remember once my accountant said to me, you can't afford to make drawings. And I said, what? What do you mean I can't afford to make drawings? He said, well, you make much more money when you're making paintings. And I said, don't ever, ever say anything like that again, because I don't want that in my head. I don't want to think which of these activities pays off financially, which ones don't.
But inherent in that comment that you don't even know how much your paintings go for is a degree of trust. I mean, you really have to trust the people that you're working with, because you don't know how much of the money is coming in, and you just assume that you're getting a check.
Well, and there are times when the work didn't sell at all, and then I, because I take a stipend from my gallery, after a while I realized that I was in debt to the company store, you know, and there have been times when they owe me money, and there's times when I owe them money, but it's part of the kind of self-deception, I suppose, that I find works well for me, that I need to disconnect the activity I love from the financial success that I've achieved.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch, and I'm talking to Chuck Close, the painter of heads. He started off doing more photorealistic paintings, and he's moved on to his famous incremental paintings. There's a quote that resonates with me. You said that you made these paintings so big because you thought, the bigger they are, the longer it takes somebody to walk past them in a gallery. And you wanted to grab them by the lapels and say, love me, hate me, but look at me. It's like the plaintive cry of a small child of most artists saying, I'm here, I made this stuff, won't you please look at it? But somewhere in there seems to be an inner confidence that if people do look at it, they are going to like it.
What is more narcissistic, I guess, than to assume that you have something to say and that somebody else should be paying attention to it? But I don't think very many people end up being artists unless they have the belief, rightly or wrongly, naively or not, that that they really do have something to say. I think one of the great things about being an artist is you can go to the grave unsuccessful, totally unsuccessful, and still feel, well, you know, that someday they're going to figure out that what I was doing was really good. Most of us, when we die, when there's no one left to talk about us, that our presence here on Earth dissipates and ultimately will disappear. But artists leave behind residue and evidence that they were here. And there's a little bit of immortality in that, you know?
You talk about memorializing your work as an artist, and luckily people have recognized Chuck Close while you're still alive, so you don't have to go to your grave hoping that people will appreciate you, you know, in the next century. But you've also memorialized your face. You've done a lot of self-portraits.
Yeah, way too many, probably.
But there is a self-love there a little bit, because you said before that you paint people whom you love and whom you want to stare at for months at a time. Mm-hmm. Why have you done so many self-portraits?
Well, I like myself. I don't think I'm particularly attractive, and I try not to flatter myself. I'm not vain. I think being bald since I was in my 20s and not looking the way I wanted to look my whole life made me less vain, perhaps. But at any rate, I do one self-portrait usually with every body of work. So about every 9 or 10 paintings, I'll do one. And it's sort of a touchstone. And it records my loss of hair and my changing eyewear. Since I don't do commissioned portraits, I don't have to flatter the sitter. The sitter, in an act of tremendous generosity, lends me his or her image with no control over what I'm going to do with it. And because they're not paying for the painting, they can't ask me to fix their nose or straighten their teeth or get rid of their zits. So if I'm going to be particularly truthful and honest about someone else's face, I have to be as ruthless and non-flattering when I paint myself.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch, and I'm talking to Chuck Close, the painter of heads. He started off doing more photorealistic paintings, and he's moved on to his famous incremental paintings. There's a story you once told. This is after your illness. You were at the museum, I think at the Met, looking at Van Eyck's and Vermeer's, and you were really impressed by the motor control that these people had to make their paintings so precise, and you were really depressed because you weren't able to achieve that ever again because of your ailment. Well, you tell the story.
I have a friend who said to me, because I was paralyzed from the shoulders down, and at that point it didn't look like I was going to regain any use of my arms. But the thing that I was really going to miss was the physicality of pushing pain around. So at any rate, I'm in the hospital. I'm trying to figure out how I can still make art. And my friend said to me, "You'll be all right because you paint with your head and not with your hands." And I thought, easy for you to say. What a Hallmark card thing to say that is. But in fact, it was true. In fact, it turns out that my fingers on my wrist don't work, and I paint with brushes strapped to my hands. But when you paint with your whole arm. Drawing requires wrist and fingers, and that's usually done on a horizontal surface. But painting, because it's done vertically, you sort of paint with your whole arm. The comment about that you're referring to came from the fact that early on, I was initially very upset that all the work that I loved the most in the museum was incredibly, usually very small, very detailed, with a great deal of virtuoso art marks. So I find myself sitting in the studio and painting away, listening to music, and I'm so happy. I'm singing along with the music, and I realize that while I'm singing, there are tears streaming down my cheeks. And it was a simultaneous loss, a sense of loss, that I had lost something that was very important to me. And at the same time, a celebratory experience that I was so happy being back to work and making things that matter to me, that I could, in fact, have both of those experiences and both of those feelings, crying and whistling, going on at the same time.
And you did really have a chapter two in 1988, and you had some allies then, just as you had allies in your earlier days, through the Walker Museum and through the Whitney.
Well, you never get anywhere without mentors or supporters or whatever. These are the, and I've had them all through my life. Actually, one of the things that really mattered a great deal to me was when I spent 8 months in the hospital and I got out, I worried a great deal about having been seen as a handicapped artist. I never minded being seen as an artist with a handicap, but I did not want to be seen as a handicapped artist. It was extremely important for me that a few people in my life who were really important to me helped me. One was the late curator of painting and sculpture at the Modern, Kirk Barnardo, who visited me often in the hospital, and Aggie Gund, who was the chairman of the board of the Modern, who visited me often. And they ended up buying the first painting that I made when I got out of the hospital. And that good housekeeping seal of approval of the Museum of Modern Art behind this work said to the art world, he's back, and the quality of the work is as good as it was before he went in the hospital. Obviously, the Museum of Modern Art is not going to buy an inferior work just to cheer me up. And that sense of the art world pulling for me was extremely important. The curator, Robert Storr, who did my retrospective at the Modern after I got out of the hospital, also did something that was very interesting. He took work from the last exhibition before I went in the hospital and the first exhibition after I got out of the hospital, and he mixed those works together in one large room. And the point being that there was no difference. Well, I'll tell you, the intervention of other people in your life often makes all the difference.
So now, just being in your current stage in life, you've been painting for five decades at this point. Do you think you'll continue doing heads?
Well, I never would have guessed 40 years ago that I would still be painting heads portraits today. And I am surprised that it still has urgency for me, and it still is that I find that's sustaining. The decision that I made initially that has allowed this to happen was after I made the first portrait heads, I thought, okay, now what am I going to paint? And I thought, well, now I'll paint apples or bottles or landscapes or something. And I thought, well, if I change the subject matter, I'm not going to change what I'm doing in the studio. My activity will stay the same, and so that will eventually become routine and ordinary and whatever. So I decided right then that I would keep the same subject matter and try to change other variables.
The process.
And the process, the technique, the materials, the scale, and that by so doing, I have kept myself engaged in what I'm doing because I changed the activity. I changed what I'm doing in the studio. And someone pointed out that the difference between me and, say, someone like Jackson Pollock was that Jackson Pollock did not know what his next painting was going to look like, but he knew precisely what he was going to be doing in the studio the next day. And conversely, I know what my next painting is going to look like. It's going to look a lot like the photograph that I'm working from, but I don't know what I'm going to be doing in the studio. And so, much to my surprise, 40 years later, I'm still finding new ways to skin the cat. And if I'm still engaged on what I'm doing and it still has urgency for me, hopefully it will still have urgency for the audience.
Well, thank you, Charles.
My pleasure.
My guest has been the American painter, Chuck Close.
Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were the pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is two brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them, and they were sort of part of who we are, and we thought it sort of symbolized what we do, so we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay.
Yeah. We held true to that, and it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York, worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern, worked briefly at Soho House, worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres, he's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that, which you just learn about the necessities of life. Food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be, it doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think it does.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and grew us, raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? I would ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of, it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows, and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, it's the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence. And it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible. Yeah, people go on now. They go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, "Look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat." Wow, you know, it's like
we really just wanted to simplify everything too, and that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on. And there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean, and any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast, and we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlowe & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all the beans by hand. We took an old piece of an old grinder or mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for flavor, to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey. And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Mast Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Mast Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Mast Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Mast Brothers, you know, much to their now ex-wives' dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together, and what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. You know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other and the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. But that also opens the door to more arguments, mm-hmm. because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
Right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So. And we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, celebrate.
After selling 30 bars at an artist market.
Like we did, really, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do. And that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, oh, that was nice, you know.
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become? Or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory offsite somewhere and all this kind of stuff. And we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth, just like food should be made slowly, with care. A company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you, just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for, A, for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. We were joking. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I've organized, I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you like look through your beautiful pantry of old timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them. You know what I mean? When we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know? So.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.